Some of you, in fact, I know for a fact, some of you, like me, enjoy detective shows, whodunits. Some of my favorites are Psych and Castle. I know some of you like NCIS and CSI. And these shows where somebody has done something unlawful, most often it's some kind of a murder, and then the detectives have to try and figure out what happened. But there are certain phrases that keep cropping up in these shows that have gotten to the point where every time I hear it, I go, there's another one. So I've put together the top three of Michael's most hated detective show quotes. These are three things you'll hear almost in every episode of any detective show there is. And it gets to the point where I just kind of roll my eyes. I did it again. Number three of the most hated detective show quotes. You don't think I could have anything to do with this, do you? Well, if they're asking for an alibi, generally speaking, yeah, they think you could have something to do with it. There's no point in being incredulous and asking, oh, you don't think I could have done this? You don't think I have anything to do with this? But they always say that, always, whether they're guilty or not. Number two of my most hated detective show quotes. You have to believe me. Based on what? You have to believe me. This is what happened. You have to believe. I don't have to do anything. And yet they always say that. Number one on my list of most hated quotes from these detective shows is, I had no choice. And almost generally at some point during the kind of cleanup, wrap-up of the episode where the guilty party is being arrested, I had no choice. I didn't have anything else I could do. I had no choice but to do what I did. Obviously, all three of these, in some form or fashion, they're somewhat cliche. But I want you to think about, especially that last one, I had no choice. Being spoken from the perspective of someone who is guilty in an effort to justify something that they have done and to say, well, I had to do this. I couldn't do anything else but what I did. And so for a few minutes this morning, I'd like to consider what that phrase represents. I had no other choice. And imagine with me three examples in the Old Testament where in a fictional setting, these individuals could be interrogated and they might very well have said the same thing. Think about in Genesis chapter 4 and in verse 6. We know that Cain and Abel brought their sacrifices as God had commanded. They brought their sacrifices to God. Abel offered up his, and God accepted it. But Cain offered up his, and God rejected it. And remember that because God rejected it, Cain was upset. And we see in Genesis chapter 4 and in verse 6, the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. Its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." And then, of course, the very next verse, verse 8, Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass they were out in the field. Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Now, we know that Cain was angry. We know that Cain's works were evil, Peter tells us. But I want you to imagine this setting where you're asking Cain, why did you do it, Cain? Picture Detective Kate Beckett on the other side of the table. You went out there and then you killed your brother. And imagine Cain responding, I had no choice. He was making me look bad. As long as Cain was the standard of giving God what he wanted, mine was never going to be accepted. I had to kill him. Can you imagine that defense being offered? Because Cain was jealous. He was upset that God had accepted Abel's, but rejected his. So as long as the standard was what Abel was offering, Cain in his mind may have felt that his was never going to be good enough. So get rid of Abel. And the Lord, of course, condemned Cain for what he did. What about Saul? In 1 Samuel chapter 13, we have the account of Saul. He's only been king for about a year. In fact, we find that in verse 1 of 1 Samuel 13. Saul had reigned for 1 year. And then we find he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, verse 1. And then we see this gathering storm against the... there in verse 3, Philistines. I was wanting to say Philippians. I don't know why. Philistines. And we see how that the Philistines have amassed a great army. And we see starting in verse 7 of 1 Samuel chapter 13. Notice with me. Some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. They were all afraid. They knew what was waiting. And in verse 8, after Samuel had told Saul, I want you to wait for 7 days for me to come to you. I'll offer the sacrifices to the Lord so that God may be with us when we go up against the Philistines. Verse 8, we find that Saul waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. And so Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal. And I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. And in verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. A lot of times we think about the situation with the Amalekites where God had commanded Saul to destroy the Amalekites utterly. He didn't do so, and as a result, it was confirmed his kingdom was going to be taken away from him. But this is what he did first. And it's this, verse 13, Samuel goes on to say, that because you have done this thing, and you have not done that which God has commanded you, verse 14, your kingdom shall not continue. He'd only been king for 2 years. But what's interesting here is notice Saul's justification of this. He said, you know what? The people were scattered. They were all afraid. You didn't come when you were supposed to. The Philistines were all gathered together. And I felt compelled to do that which was unlawful. Saul had no right or authority to offer sacrifices to the Lord, and yet he did so anyway. Why? Why, Saul? Why'd you do it, Saul? I had no choice. I was between a rock and a hard place here. I needed the people to be confident, and I needed to appeal to the Lord for his help. So I offered the sacrifice. Even though I wasn't supposed to, I had no other choice. Kind of the feeling you get from Saul here. I felt compelled, he says, and offered a burnt offering. See, Saul was the king. And even though the commandment of God did not allow for Saul to offer up the sacrifices, he did so anyway. What about David? In 2 Samuel chapter 11, 2 Samuel chapter 11. This, we're not talking about specifically the sin with Bathsheba.
He had a choice to make, and he made his choice. It's what he did after that we want to focus in on here. When it became clear that Bathsheba was with child from David, notice the extent that David went to hide it. First, we find, starting in verse 6, that David sends for Uriah. He tries to cover up the fact that she is with child and tries to pressure Uriah to go home to be with his wife. That way Uriah would think it was his child. But Uriah refuses to do that. While my comrades are out in the heat of battle, I'm not going to go home and enjoy the pleasantries of being home. I came to deliver the message. The pretense was to deliver a report as to how things were going. And so David tried to get him drunk. So, you know what, maybe if I can give him wine and try to get him drunk, he'll not even think about what he's doing and he'll just go home. Verse 12, David said to Uriah, "Wait here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart." And in verse 13, David called him, and he ate and drank before him and made him drunk. And at evening, he went out to lie in his bed with the servants of his Lord, but he did not go down to his house. Twice, David concocted a plan to try to cover up his sin with Bathsheba. But refused, Uriah did, to go home. So what was the third effort from David? Verse 14, David wrote a letter to Joab. Sent it by the hand of Uriah, and it just happened to be his own death sentence. And what David wanted Joab to do was, in the heat of the battle, with Uriah on the front lines, "I want you to retreat, leaving those frontline soldiers there to defend you while you retreat." And what David's hope was that Uriah would die in the midst of that battle. And we see in verse 17, some of the servants of David fell. Uriah the Hittite died also. If you had David on the other side of that interrogation table, and you said, "David, you went so far, not only to try to cover up your sin with Bathsheba, you got him drunk and tried to cover up your sin with Bathsheba, and then you gave the order. You might as well have been the one that delivered the blow from the sword or the arrow from the bow. You sentenced him to death to cover your sin." It didn't really occur to David, everything that he had done and the full extent of it, until Nathan comes in chapter 12. But in that moment, David had to justify that somehow. Just as Cain may have thought to himself, "I've got to get rid of Abel." He was angry, he was jealous. Maybe he even thought, "I don't have a choice, I've got to kill him." Just as Saul thought, "I don't have any other choice, I've got to offer up these sacrifices or else my people are going to scatter and I'm going to die." David, in this moment, as he's justifying in himself, imagine David, the man after God's own heart, three times tries to get this cover-up in place, finally succeeds that third time. Why? He didn't feel he had a choice. He didn't want it to come to light. He didn't want people to find out about it, the shame and the humiliation and everything else that may have gone with it. So he tried to get rid of the evidence. And it goes to show that in all three of these events, the links that people, even people after God's own heart, can sometimes go to justify in themselves things that otherwise they would recognize as being wrong and sinful. And yet they did it anyway. Because in that moment, they thought they had no choice. But the issue, the key component of saying to myself, "I have no choice," Really what I'm saying when I say that is, I didn't have a choice in order to bring about the conclusion that I wanted. The result that Cain wanted was to have Abel out of the way. Maybe he even thought that God will have to accept my sacrifice then. So the end result of that then dictated the means. I had no choice. In order to get the end result that I sought, I offered the sacrifices, even though I wasn't commanded to. I tried to cover up the sin with Bathsheba, ultimately killing Uriah, because I had no choice in order to obtain the result that I already wanted. We talk about the concept of excuses, and this would be one. I felt compelled. I didn't feel I had any other choice. It's an excuse. And what that excuse does is it serves the purpose of providing the mind a sense of peace or justification for doing something they knew full well they shouldn't have done. And it is a, albeit extremely weak, argument to those to appeal, for instance, to our justice system as being, put yourself in my shoes and think about and feel what I would have thought and felt. Maybe you would have done the same thing. But imagine come judgment day, people make that argument to Jesus as he sits on the throne of judgment, at the judgment seat. I didn't have a choice, Jesus. When Jesus had a choice, and in every decision of his life, leading up to and including his death on the cross, he had the choice. He chose to give himself up. In Romans chapter 1, notice what Paul says about the Gentiles and what they did with regard to their mind. He says in verse 18 that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. God has shown his power. Notice verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power. God, the nature of God's power, can be seen in creation. And yet people who don't want to see it, notice they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They don't want to hear it. And this is why Paul says in verse 20, so that they are without excuse. No matter what excuse they may provide to God, they have none, because he had left himself a testimony in creation. Verse 21, because although they knew God, what did they do? They did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but they became futile in their thoughts. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. What did they do? They redefined God. And as long as they didn't remember or chose not to think about the Jehovah who created all things, who gave to man a law for them to follow, they could excuse themselves, because their gods that they had created perhaps allowed them to do these things that they wanted to do. And yet, Paul says they're without excuse. They can go as far as redefining who God is or what God is as much as they want to, but that excuse will not matter. One chapter over in Romans chapter 2, as Paul then turns his attention to the Jewish Christian in Rome, Paul says, therefore, you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. for you who judge, practice the same things. He's not condemning pointing out sin in other people's life to help them to understand what they need to do to be saved. That's not what he's condemning. Jesus himself says in John chapter 7 that we are to judge not according to appearance, but judge according to righteous judgment. What Paul's condemning, as Jesus did in Matthew 7, judge not lest ye be judged. Jesus himself in that context is defining hypocritical judgment. First, take the beam out of your own eye so that you can see clearly to help your brother in his life, to remove the speck from his eye. Paul's dealing with the same concept of hypocritical judgment. Verse 2, we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against those who practice such things. Do you think this, O man, you who judge those practicing such things and doing the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? Do you despise the riches of his goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads you to repentance? But in accordance with your hardness, your impenitent heart, you are treasuring up for yourself wrath in the day of wrath and judgment of the righteous, or and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, who will render according to each one his deeds. Eternal life to those who by patient continuance in doing good seek for glory and honor and immortality. But to those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation, and wrath. And he concludes in verse 11, for there is no partiality with God. Notice how Paul lumps these Jewish Christians who are redefining what sin is. He lumps them into this group of they are self-seeking, do not obey the truth, they obey unrighteousness. No, Paul. No, we follow God, we follow Jesus. What does Paul say? No, you've redefined what is sin. Notice he says, you who practice such things, or you who judge, practice the same things that you condemn in others. Maybe it wasn't the same apple to apple type concept. Maybe it was to a lesser degree. See, as long as it's not as blatant or as obvious a sin as the Gentiles may have been guilty of, what I'm doing is nothing compared to what they're doing. Their idea of stealing blatantly in the marketplace, I don't steal, even though maybe I cheat my way through people, from people trying to see what I can gain. Maybe I cheat them out of what I owe them. Maybe I don't pay what I'm supposed to with regard to my taxes. It's still stealing. No, it's completely different. Their sin is blatant. What I do isn't stealing. Yet Paul says, verse 3, O man, do you think this? You who judge those practicing such things, and you do the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? What was the excuse? What was the mindset for the hypocrisy? That it's not the same for me as it is for them. This is why Paul concludes in verse 11, there is no partiality with God. The Jew thought that the Jewish Christian to whom Paul's writing thinks to himself that he will be judged by a different standard than that which they themselves were holding to the Gentiles, and in fact, rightfully. It wasn't that the Gentile or the Roman Jews here had the wrong idea of what was sinful. It sounds like they were appropriately applying it, but they were hypocritically doing it. They weren't following the same standard. As if my standard's more lenient. And the excuse would be that the sin isn't the same. It's not the same thing. It's not as bad as what they're doing. See, when you make excuses to justify yourself, it can lead you to redefine who God is. God and Allah are the same God, people say. Or they say that God is all love. He won't send anyone, condemn anyone to hell. When you start describing characteristics of Jehovah that do not exist, that go contrary to what the scriptures teach, you are no longer describing Jehovah, you're describing a false God. A God that allows for, as long as you accept Jesus into your heart, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to change your life. Even atheists can go to heaven. That's not what the Bible teaches. That's not what Jehovah teaches. So when people teach that, when they say that, they're not describing Jehovah. They are redefining God in the way that they want. And when people think to themselves that God won't condemn me for this sin because I'm a Christian, He condemns everybody else. Or I think in terms of degrees of sin. Oh, theirs is blatant. Mine isn't. It's not the same thing. I redefine sin. That is what the temptation is to redefine God and to redefine sin so that I can justify how I want to live. But those excuses will not get us to heaven. And that's where Luke chapter 14 comes in. In the passage that Neil read for us in Luke chapter 14, we have the example, or the, I guess you'd call it a parable, that Jesus offers, that he teaches here, about this master. He's prepared a great feast, and he's selected individuals that he wants to come to eat in this feast. And notice it says in verse 16, Luke chapter 14, and in verse 16, a certain man gave a great supper and invited many. He sent his servant out, verse 17, to give the invitation, says, "Come, all things are now ready." But three times this invitation was extended. Three times those who were invited to this great feast made up excuses. Verse 18, they all with one accord began to make excuses. The first one says, "I bought a piece of ground. I need to go and look at it. I can't come. I need to take care of some stuff, you know, my business with this ground and all this." Verse 19, another said, "I bought 5 yoke of oxen. I'm going to go test them. I don't have time for the feast. I got to take care of my business stuff here with these 5 oxen." Another one says, he doesn't even ask to be excused. But verse 20, he says, I've gotten married and my wife won't let me come. They bring up these excuses, these reasons why they can't go to this great feast. And notice when the servant comes back and reports what had happened, verse 21. The servant came and reported these things to his master. The master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, "Fine. Forget these individuals that I've invited. Go out everywhere. Go to the streets and the lanes and bring in the poor and the maimed and the lame and the blind. Anybody who is willing to come, let them come." And so, after the servant has done what was commanded, and there is still room, well, should we go back and try to pressure these people? Go back to these individuals to whom the invitation was extended and they declined it? Made up excuses? Notice what the master says. The master says to his servant, verse 24, "I say to you that none of those men who were invited shall taste my supper." None of them will, because they made up excuses to do the things that they wanted to do, to justify in themselves reasons why they couldn't go and eat of that supper. They offered up these excuses. And Jesus says, they will not be invited to taste my supper. And the representation here is, of course, regarding the Jews who had been given the word of God through Moses, the Ten Commandments and the Mosaical Law and the prophecies. They had been foretold what would happen. In fact, even after the establishment of the church, Paul and his teachings would go first to the synagogues, because you'd think those would be the people who'd be willing to listen the most. Ironically, it wasn't. But what Jesus is describing here is bring everybody in. Not just these ones that were invited, They've made excuses to why they can't come. Bring everybody else. If they're willing to come, let them come. It goes to show the danger of excuses. Not only can lead one to redefine God, can redefine sin, but the whole point of it is to justify what I want and the reasons why I do what I want. But when people get to judgment, and people try, and they will try, to make excuses for why they did this or didn't do that, Jesus will say, look, I offered you an invitation, and you refused. You came up with excuses as to why I'm not going to be baptized today. Maybe next week, maybe next year, maybe when I'm a little older, let me enjoy my youth, and then maybe when I'm older, I'll come. People who make up excuses thinking, I didn't have any other choice. This is what I wanted as an end result. In order to achieve that, this is what I had to do. I had no choice. I'll say to you, none of those who were invited shall taste my supper. Those who were invited and made up excuses as to why they can't make it. Some of you know, most of you know, almost all of you know, I'm kind of a sci-fi tend to be. My favorite Star Trek, Star Wars, take it or leave it. Babylon 5, speaking. But there's a quote that I came across. Incidentally, this is from Lady Morella, played by Gene Roddenberry's real-life wife, who was also in Star Trek. She was speaking to Ambassador Mallari. Mallari was wants her to give him a glimpse to the future. Because he doesn't know, he thinks that something is greater for him, but he doesn't know if it's something good or bad. And he says, I don't know if it's still time to turn away from it or if I have no other choice now. And that's what he asks her. He says, I don't know if I can still turn away from what's going to happen or if I have no choice in the matter. And this is what she says to him. She says, there is always choice. We say there is no choice only to comfort ourselves with the decision we've already made. In other words, we say there is no choice as an excuse. Because we've already decided what we want to do. We've already decided what the end result is going to be. And so we say, I have no choice to comfort ourselves. To justify it to ourselves. The same process takes place within those to whom the gospel call is sent, and they hear it. And maybe they're even afraid and trembling, as Felix was. But then something gets in the way. Greed, politics, lifestyle choices. And they say, maybe at a more convenient time. Or like Agrippa, almost you persuade me. But as we sing in our hymn, almost but lost. We need to beware of the dangers of excuses. Because this doesn't just apply to people who aren't Christians, who are called through the gospel to hear the words of Jesus when he says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. That call certainly is for them. But the danger, the warning is also for us. Just as Paul warned regarding the Jewish Christian in Romans chapter 2, who was hypocritically redefining sin in himself, thinking that he wasn't subject to the same standard. We have to be very careful because often we can justify and make excuses in our own minds as to why we can't make it to worship service on Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon. Or make it to Bible study with the saints on Wednesday night. Make up excuses for why we kind of maybe yield in the face of ridicule. People who might make fun of us, our friends, our co-workers, cause us to maybe back down and not speak up as maybe we should. Maybe cause us to justify actions and behavior, lifestyles that we know God does not approve of. And yet, I had no choice. In order for me to obtain the result that I wanted from my life, this is the way I had to live it. This is the type of job I had to have, type of education I had to get. And so everything else didn't matter except the end result. The ends don't justify the means. No excuse is going to get us to heaven. Doesn't work that way. Only submitting and doing what God tells us to will. We offer the invitation to those who are not Christians to be baptized. That is washed away. Those of us who are Christians, to make sure we're being honest with ourselves, looking at ourselves in the full picture, looking in any areas in our life where we might be making excuses. We offer an invitation to anyone who needs help for their soul, who might be sitting here right now saying, maybe next week, maybe next year. I'd have to give up too much right now to become a Christian. I'd have to change too much in my life. I don't have a choice. I have to wait. No excuse is going to get us into heaven. But any and all excuses will keep us out of it. Will you obey the gospel call now? The invitation is extended. If you're subject, come forward as we stand and sing.